This is a possible reconsideration of work session on House Bill 2163. There was a conflict amendment, so Mr. Dodson, you discuss that.
House Bill 2163, as this was being passed out of committee, the House Bill 2526 was being passed out of the judiciary. Apparently there were conflicting language, so dash one amendments that have been provided to the committee members. It adds two sections to 2163 to resolve conflicts. If House Bill 2526 passes, it requires an administrative law judge to include notice of dismissal of the request for a hearing to all concerned parties, and the administrative law judge may dismiss the request for hearing under specified circumstances.
Okay, so this is just a reconciliation and
correct
two sketches, and we've taken the testimony. There's only one person that testified, and that was from the agents. And does anybody have any questions on the dash one?
Mr. Chair, can we make a motion? Well, first we have to move for the reconsider, don't we?
Yeah, we have to move now.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which we passed out House Bill 2163.
Senator Byers moved that we reconsider the vote by which we passed out 2163. Any questions or any more discussion? There's conflict resolution ordered. So the reconsideration of the 2163, the dash one amendments, is that it?
Right.
Yeah, I move the dash one amendments.
Suspend the rules here.
Shouldn't have to be had on the agenda.
Okay. Reconsider. All right. So dash one amendments. Chair moves dash one amendments. Conflict resolution, discussions, objections. So ordered. And the chair would remove House Bill 2163 with the amendments resolving the conflicts to the board with a two-pass recommendation. Discussions, objections, so forth. Who was carried?
Meyer was.
Thank you. We'll get you that one.
Hey, all right. That's a good job.
What'd you do?
We just need to go change title on people who want.
Open up work session on Senate Bill 103. Mr. Dodson. Where are we?
Senate Bill 103. Require seller of motor vehicle to return items of value to buyer if lender does not agree to finance sales or lease transaction on exact terms negotiated between seller and buyer within 14 days of seller's offer. Declares emergency effective on passage. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and there are dash three amendments, which resolve some issues that were discussed in the hearing on 411.
We didn't have those amendments in the recall on 411.
Did you say dash threes or dash twos?
Dash three is what you have.
Is that in our packet?
Yes, they are actually delivered to your office this morning.
Oh. I got dash two.
I have dash two.
That's all I've got.
Yeah.
We have great office staff. I just don't know what happened.
I've got two copies of the dash two.
So do I.
Okay, well, we'll recess the work session on Senate Bill 103 until we get those amendments back, and we'll open up work sessions on Senate Bill 206 and, well, yes, please come forward. 206, Dennis, you want to talk about those?
Senate Bill 206 implements a client trust account overdraft notification program for real estate licensees, reconciles discrepancies in current statutes related to a specified three-year period. There are dash two amendments to this.
Okay. Janet, do you want to come up and just sort of talk about the dash twos? Scott. Welcome, sir. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Taylor. I'm the Oregon Real Estate Commissioner. The dash two amendments that you have resolve the problems that we had with the original bill, and primarily what they do is take out that part about the overdraft notification program.
Any questions on the dash twos? Discuss. Chair, move the dash two amendments. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Chair would move Senate Bill 206 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just a question on the original paper, the original testimony that we got from the real estate agency. It said the dash one and the dash two amendments make technical and typographic changes. So the dash one is now out of play, but even though they were referenced in this document dated, what was the date of this document? April 9th.
The dash ones are out of play now. They're not, the dash ones are no longer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Byers, my understanding is the dash two incorporate the dash ones that survive.
Janet, do you have some, you're going to come up and explain this all to us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jana Jarvis for the Oregon Association of Realtors. I thought the dash two amendments, and I will plead a little bit of ignorance, but I thought they solved or were aimed to correct a different problem than the dash ones, and I think we need both. It was my understanding that we needed both sets of amendments, because the dash ones corrected some errors in the original bill draft that were not addressed in the dash two amendments.
I stand corrected.
Is that correct, Scott?
Yes.
So we both need both the dash ones and the dash twos in order. So thank you, Senator Beyer, for bringing that issue up. So explain to us again how so we get this straight for the record. Dash ones do what now again?
Well, Mr. Chair, the dash ones and the dash twos are primarily housekeeping at this point to resolve some problems that we had with the implementation of Senate Bill 446. There's some typographical errors as well as a few substantive.
And the dash ones are just, they just add some sentences on, basically. Any questions about the dash ones?
Mr. Chair, if my understanding of the dash twos were going to incorporate what the dash ones were trying to
I think we just need to make sure, Mr. Chair, that the sentences we that see in the dash one.
Why don't we recess this work session while you guys go out and work this out and kind of give us clarification so we know exactly where we are. So we'll recess work session here on 206. Okay, and we'll open up a work session on House Bill 2210. Mr. Dowd.
House Bill 2210 directs the Oregon Department of Water Resources to increase the amount of surety bonds or irrevocable letter of credit required for contracting or offering services to contract for well construction, alteration, abandonment, or conversion. We heard this bill on April 14th. And there was a question that Senator Beyer had made regarding whether the well drillers had actually been contacted and been a part of this process.
Right. And Senator Beyer, did you get any contact then as far as the increase in the bonding level?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I was notified by a constituent that you knew of the bill and were happy with it. So at least one well driller out there knew of the bill.
Yeah, we don't have any amendments on this.
No, sir.
Mm-hmm. Any other further discussion on House Bill 2210? Before the chair moves it to the floor of the D-Pass recommendation. Chair so moves. Any discussion on House Bill 2210? Any objections? Anybody have a desire to carry that?
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Senator Biden, my fee increases even if the receiver does.
Okay.
That means that's not a fee increase.
Open up a work session on House Bill 2245. Mr. Dunn.
House Bill 2245 increases licensing periods for occupational therapists from 1 to 2 years, modifies established license fee, requiring occupational therapy license board to establish license renewal fees, and modifies the executive secretary position to director as a minimal fiscal impact. This was heard by the committee on April 16th, and Senator Beyer made inquiry of one of the people testifying as to whether the fees were established in statute or out of statute. And since then, a response has been prepared and delivered to the committee members.
Okay, discussions on House Bill 2245. Senator Barr, you have very interesting request to answer. This is a fee bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question, I'm trying to get to the bill because I was still looking at 20, whatever it was, 6 earlier. Mr. Chair, question of Mr. Dotson.
Yes.
The document you provided me in my office spoke to the different types of fees and statute, and I guess my question was more specifically of the medical licensing boards, how many of them have their fees capped in statute, or and how many of them do we have to approve after the fact?
That was not, I misunderstood then as far as what you were seeking.
And I apologize, I didn't get to you prior to reading your memo. After reading your memo, I didn't get a chance to get to you, but that was my question, Mr. Chair, was more specifically, you've got your medical board and your nurses board and your chiropractic board and God knows how many others, licensing board. There's like 30 medical licensing boards. And of those, how many of those cap their fees in statute, and how many of them do they have to come absent to the fact to get retroactive approval by the legislature?
In the document that I did provide, when it was speaking of the statutes, Senate Bill 333, passed in 1995, the statute specifically authorizing state agencies to establish fees are not effective until the granting authorities approve them, and then it describes that for agencies in the executive department, need approval of the Department of Administrative Services before they can impose fees. So my understanding was, and when I did contact a few agencies, that they are allowed to raise the fees after obtaining the approval that they need from either the Department of Administrative Services, or if they're within the Judicial Department, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, or if they are a legislative department from the Director of the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House. They're able then, once they get that approval, to raise the fees and come back to the session and present them during their budget to the process as it was explained to me, and then seek approval for that fee increase. If it's not approved, it reverts back to what the fee was before that increase took place. I was not led to believe that any of them are capped, that they have authority to raise them in many instances, but I will double check on that specifically.
Hey, if you want to move it. I mean, I can know and get more information. And
I think we should just move it out. I think the way the process is, I know Senator Barr has some problems with the way the process is, but the way it sounds is that they do these. I'm providing this following information for a telephone conversation with Senator Barr's request. So it looks like 3 of them do it by statute, and 2, 4, 6, 8 do it by rule. Does that answer your question? You want to come on up and discuss some of these things? We'll try and get all this thing straightened out here. In response to Senator Byers' questions, I mean, you've had time to think about it.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Peggy Smith, and I'm the executive officer for the Occupational Therapy Licensing Board. It was my understanding, Senator Byer, that you had a question about how the other boards address their fees and whether they're in statute. It wasn't informal. I talked to the boards in my suite of offices and the list that you have. I believe there were 11 of the boards that I surveyed,
three of them, including the Occupational Therapy Board, has their fees set in statute. The Pharmacy Board kind of does. They have a ceiling or an up-to amount in statute, and then they set their fees through administrative rules within that limitation.
Okay.
Someone answer your question.
Mr. Chair, this is what I was looking for. And under the current, the way your board works with the Occupational Therapy Board, if you don't want, I mean, you can adjust your fees up to the statutory cap without coming back to the legislature for approval. Is that correct?
Some of the fees were stated fees, like the initial license, I believe, was $75. Some of the fees are stated, and the renewal fee was up to a certain amount, so it's both ways in our statute.
But the ones that are up to a certain amount, you can adjust those fees up to that amount without coming back to us for approval afterwards, correct? Or do you still have to come back?
I believe if we change the fees, I'm sure it would be part of the budget presentation at the next legislative session. Because it's up to, we would be within the statutory limitation, but the budget approval process itself would also be an approval of the fees that the board would be requesting.
That's true, but you don't have to come to a substantive committee to ask for us to retroactively approve your fees, or they go back down to where they were.
Chair Nelson and Senator Byer, I believe that's correct.
Thank you.
Answer your question.
My question keeps me now.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Any further questions on this bill?
There's great value in having fees set by administrative rule, Mr. Chair.
You like fees, don't you?
Well, I just like them to be flexible.
Okay. Senator Mitchell, question.
Let them down.
Chair would move House Bill 2245 and forward with due pass recommendation.
Right,
questions? Please indicate that there's one no vote. Senator Byer is a no vote. Mm-hmm. And motion is carried. Do you want me to carry it? I'll carry it.
You're feeling comfortable today.
Okay, we see the real estate folks are back, and so we'll read them from the. We're going to work session. Where are we on House for Senate Bill 206? Okay. Welcome back. We got it all straightened out.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Scott Taylor, Real Estate Commissioner. Again, we've confirmed from two sources that the Dash 2s do, in fact, incorporate the Dash 1s.
Oh, this is good to know. Is there any further questions?
Mr. Chair, Section 10A, which is an amendment to 696.265, is not in the Dash 2s. So does that mean we no longer need to amend that statute?
Where is that? So we have a reference to it.
I'm looking at page 3 on the dash 1s of the amendment to ORS 696.265. That is not in the dash 2s. I'm just making sure that we all are in agreement. We don't need that.
That's line 27, is that?
Lines 20 through 26.
20 through 26.
Mm-hmm. On the dash 1s.
Okay.
I just want to be clear for the record that that's what we don't, that we don't need to do that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, my copy of Dash 2s do have Section 10A in them, beginning at line 24 on page 4.
Mr. Chair, that is correct, but it's a different 10A.
I see. The one that we're, Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, the one we're concerned about is the amendments to 696.301.
Okay. So I'll just make sure we're clear.
Keep our record. Okay, very good. So we're just concerned with the dash 2 amendments.
So, Mr. Chair,
yes.
I move the dash 2 to Senate Bill 206.
Okay, Senator Watkins moves the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 206. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered.
And Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 206 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved Senate Bill 206 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Discussions? Objections? So ordered. Okay, now. Okay. Well, we've got a series of bills, so you might as well stay right there. We can open up the work session on Senate Bill 207. And Mr. Duff?
Senate Bill 207 creates limited escrow license for real estate businesses, requires minimal competency requirements for continuing education, incorporates corporate bond rate, creates alternative of bond to cash deposit, no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, that's for the Real Estate Commission, and there are dash four amendments.
Okay, what are the dash fours?
The dash fours implement provisions for issuance of limited escrow licenses, and modifies pre-licensing application requirements, clarifies continuing education requirements, restores authority for escrow agents to act as trustee of a trust fund, and establishes an effective date of July 1, 2004.
Commissioner, you have any discussions on
Mr. Chair, Scott Taylor from the Real Estate Agency. I think Mr. Dotson pretty well summarized it. The big change in the dash fours is the elimination of the modifications to RS 86790, which I understand there was some concern about last when the bill was heard.
Any further questions on the dash fours?
Is that the deal with the concern from Representative Butler?
Yeah, that was my question.
Chair, Senator Beyer, I wasn't here. I can speak to that it does represent the concern that former Senator Bryant raised, and I did speak to him on the phone last week.
It is my understanding that we took care of Representative Butler's issues very early on in the process, that he was on board with. Jana, would you? I have a letter from him dated way back in February 14th, but as I understood that there was higher bonding costs proposed for escrow companies, I understood we took care of that problem. Do you know anything about that?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that we have, yes. In fact, I happen to be speaking to the agents group, which is the smaller escrow companies that work throughout the state going over this bill on Saturday, and they seem to be fine with it. We have added some things, I think, that addressed Representative Butler's concerns to where it doesn't put those folks, so to speak, out in the cold.
His concerns, as I said, was out for it very early, but I think we could resolve those. The issue at hand was the fact that former Senator Bryant was here, and there was some escrow people that were left out of the bill. We deleted the language, which would have affected just a small portion of it. But it was significant enough that we needed to change that. So. Further questions?
Mr. Chair, I'd move the dash form. Senate Bill 207.
Senator Walker has moved the dash for amendments to Senate Bill 207. Seems like we're still studying a little there.
I just had a question, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Because I forgot where we were. Have we already included the dash threes, or just since we had this question a moment ago, or the dash fours and incorporation of dash three in this as well? Maybe just save us a little time.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, when I phoned on the previous bill, I asked the same question of this one, and I'm told yes, it does incorporate the previous amendments.
Okay. Further issues, Senator Metzger?
No.
Everybody likes it.
Let's see. Happy again. All right. Senator Walker has moved to ask for amendments to Senate Bill 207. Objections? So ordered. And the chair moves Senate Bill 207 to floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussions?
Do you notice, Mr. Chair, the fees hadn't been increased since
1963? I didn't notice that. Oregon's a big state to live. Charge a lot of fees. Any further discussion?
I think we've heard from the buffer if the solution wasn't for a problem.
Okay, Chair's moved Senate Bill 7207 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objections? So ordered. You right there, both
Michael Perryman Tandem.
Okay. And stay right there, Scott. We've got another real estate bill. It's House Bill 2639A. We'll open a public hearing on that. 2639.
Mr. Chair, I think that's someone else. It isn't us.
Did they get the wrong one there?
It's a real estate bill, but I think that's the real estate.
Okay, that's fine. All right.
Folks.
Mr. Dodson.
House Bill 2639A allows real estate broker, principal real estate broker, or escrow agent to generate interest earnings on client funds held in trust. Interest earnings from trust account to assist public benefit corporation for funding first-time home buyers assistance and development of affordable housing. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact. No amendments.
Yeah, very good. What do we got here? We got Bob Repine someplace back there. Bob Repine. 2639. Gary Conklin. Janet.
Mr. Chairman,
I'm with Janet. Go ahead, Janet. Why don't you both come up at the same time? I'm going to say the whole thing.
Okay.
Janet, please start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Janet Jarvis for the Oregon Association of Realtors. I like, after I misspoke on the last bill, that you asked Scott to come and testify on this bill for me, so that was probably appropriate. But
it is.
We were a little confused over the amendments to 206. OAR, the Oregon Association of Realtors, brings House Bill 2639 before you today in search of a proactive and a positive solution to the lack of affordable housing in Oregon. We recognize that home ownership contributes to community responsibility, economic stability, and family security. Home ownership creates value to communities because families have a financial stake in the well-being of their neighborhoods. I haven't given you some written testimony. That was my intention, to give you some written testimony. Thank you. I apologize. It is Monday all day today. I apologize for that. In any event, when you get my written testimony, you will notice that it states that Oregon bucks the trend when it comes to home ownership. We currently have the 9th lowest rate in the country, and our ownership rates are on the decline. We would contend that this is the result of a variety of factors, such as our excessive regulatory burdens and high development fees. But the net result is a lack of affordable home ownership. To give you some specifics, Portland is 163rd, Eugene is 169th, and Salem is 157th out of 191 cities nationwide in terms of affordability. While record low interest rates have kept the housing market strong in Oregon, they don't address the problem of low-income families that are unable to afford a down payment. We bring you House Bill 2639 to help reverse this trend. This is a very simple bill that will allow escrow funds to be placed in an interest-bearing account to generate funds for the benefit of a charitable foundation dedicated to first-time home buying assistance in the development of affordable housing. Clients would receive written notice of this arrangement before their funds were deposited. Our intention is to work with other affected industries and organizations to set up this charitable foundation once House Bill 2639 takes effect. Quite frankly, this idea came to us in our association with some of the other states in the National Association of Realtors who have already implemented similar programs. Colorado is the most recent example, and I've included a brief summary of their program on the back of my written testimony. This is a voluntary program, and in the first couple of years in Colorado, they've raised between $300,000 and $500,000, and the program is growing. Some states have given these dollars as grants, while others have leveraged these dollars, and these funds are repaid at the point of resale. I look forward to working with other organizations to help develop and sell this program to our members, and I request that you support House Bill 2639 today. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services, here to speak in behalf and in support of House Bill 2639. But I do want to let the committee be aware of that as this bill will raise, as is assumed to raise somewhere between $300,000 and $500,000 on an annual basis, and I think it's very laudable that the realtors have stepped up to the plate to identify a way to help start addressing the issues of affordability in the state of Oregon. Realize that this will be this is a small piece of a large picture of things that need to be accomplished in Oregon, and particularly around affordable housing. All of you should be aware of the fact that both in the co-chair's budget that was recently published as of last week and the governor's budget, the agency on housing, which deals with the affordable commodities on affordable housing, will be reduced considerably. So, in one hand, this is a positive light that we're going to be able to possibly get some resources here. But the other side is that we, as a state, are abandoning or walking away from some of the larger pictures of affordable housing for low-income Oregonians. Currently, we have programs that we have been administering. Just to give you an idea, for similar programs like this, we have a $300,000 first-time homebuyer program that's administered by the Bankers Association. That's uses the state's dollars to encourage the bankers to both train and direct people to home ownership. We have a $200,000 like program with the Oregon mortgage lenders, and then we have a $200,000 program with the Habitat for Humanity House programs. So we have been in the marketplace, just as Jana is advocating for their group to be in the marketplace, trying to make affordable housing become a reality. So those tools have been in place for some time. We as an agency, just so you'll know, place somewhere between 1,200 to 1,400 first-time homebuyers in a home in Oregon on an annual basis. Now, our programs are income-tested. So they have to meet some level of affordability relative to their income. And today that's approximately $56,000 as your annual income.
Approximately how much?
$56,000. In most of the state, I think it's actually a little higher in two areas. That would be Benton County and the metropolitan area.
Mr. Chair, is that a two-person household or a single?
Could be a two or a one. So you and with my agency have been investing in first-time home buyers at a considerable rate. Those loans constitutes about $160 million every year that we put into the first-time home buyer program for the state of Oregon to address home ownership. With the cuts we'll be seeing in both the proposed budgets, we don't know where we'll go. So obviously, again, anything we can get that complements what we were doing, even though it's going to be possibly by another associate or nonprofit organization, we would like to, and we've talked to the realtors about this, and we want to work in with them on maybe setting up and talking about the parameters and how this might. We have programs that would fit the same needs that they're trying to propose here. We have a program called ABCs of Home Buying, which is another program it's run by the bank and the mortgage companies to better prepare people to become homeowners. In today's environment, home ownership is something that is more of an art in some cases of people's lives because they've never had anybody have taught them how to be a homeowner. They've maybe have lived in a couple generations of being renters, and now the opportunity for home ownership will change how their responsibilities and how they look at home ownership versus being a renter might be. So the training is important, the resources. I'm proud to tell you that you as a state legislative members are able to offer first-time homebuyer mortgages today for 30-year fixed mortgages at 4.95% interest. It's the lowest it's ever been since we've been in the first-time homebuyer program in the state. These are pre-World War II rates, quite frankly. So there is a need. I think the realtors are being good stewards of the industry and trying to figure out other ways to leverage opportunities for home ownership. But again, the picture is a larger picture than that. And including in that larger picture, we have to talk. I would like to also tell you that home ownership is the way out, and it's the best way to have people vest in their community, vest in what their ability is for pride, invest in something that will gain them increased value over time. But we also have the issue on multifamily that we struggle with all the time. And so these two items go hand in hand. In Oregon today, over almost 80% of Oregonians pay over 50% of their income on rent. And the rule of thumb is it shouldn't be over 30%. So we have people who are paying more than they should be paying because of either jobs not being adequate in pay or rents being higher than they can bear. And that's where the other indirect issues start coming about. Food insecurity, health issues. We don't get health care for people. And so all of a sudden, we, you know, it all starts blossoming together to find out we've got, we have a situation that can be changed and improve by improving that broader look of the housing inventory in the Oregon, because if we can make rents and housing more affordable, then people will not be using so much of their disposable income for the rent or the payment of the house, and they can use it for their groceries, for their families, or they can do it for their medical services. So it is it's a huge issue in the state of Oregon, like other states. Again, this is a great step toward addressing it. We look forward to working with the realtors on it, but I didn't want anybody in the committee to lose sight that there is a bigger issue out there that we still are struggling with daily.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good job on the budget pitch, Bob. I always knew you'd come through, and certainly agree with you on that. I had a question, though, regarding the public benefit corporations that this money would go to. Do you have any idea of how many of these public, I know it's defined in statute, I just kind of wondered how broad of a list this is, or maybe some examples of public benefit corporations that might receive these funds.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I actually pulled up the Internal Revenue Service description of public benefit corporations today, so I could speak to this. It says the term charitable is used in its generally accepted legal sense and includes relief of the poor, the distressed, or the underprivileged. It talks about how the organization has to be organized and how assets have to be dedicated to exempt purposes. So it's pretty narrowly defined in statute.
Well, I was just curious, Mr. Chair, would the Housing Trust Fund be a recipient of that potentially?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I would think probably not, because we're not a 503 nonprofit or 501c1. 501c3. We're neither of those. And quite frankly, I think there's a way that the realtor strategy here can work well with us in some of our programs, so we can actually complement. We also run another program that many of you may be aware of. It's called the Individual Development Accounts, IDAs, which allows Oregonians to vest a dollar for either education, home ownership, or cottage industry working at their house. And there are areas where you have tax credits that are out there where if somebody puts a dollar in, they can get as much as $2 to match it on an ongoing basis. So you have that little extra resource going on, and with that, along with the Realtors program and maybe our first-time home buyer program, I think together we can make a better, stronger, better covered opportunity here. So I don't think we'd want to be in that business, quite frankly. We would rather work with the partners at it.
Sure. And then, Jana, I guess this would be for you. The way it's written is that these will not necessarily go into an interest-bearing account. It's with the mutual understanding of all those with the trust. So in order to really totally benefit from this, because like all of us, I know realtors are habits of agent. I mean, rule by habit, and they get certain places they put their money, and they just do that. That this would really require some type of marketing plan to agents to let them know that this is now underway. And I was just wondering if the Oregon Association of Realtors is going to plan some type of marketing and education campaign to the various realtors to let them know that when this becomes law, that this is available and might be a wise way to adjust their escrow account deposits.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Metzger, now you know what I'll be doing in the interim. I think you're exactly right. It will require a program to be put together on our behalf, and it needs to be sold to our members. Current statute says that you can't put client trust funds in interest-bearing accounts unless you have written permission. So as a practical matter, they go in non-interest-bearing accounts. So we see this as an opportunity to create a new source of revenue that doesn't exist today.
Well, that last question that Senator Metzger's is really the heart of my question, because when I refinanced my house this year, like everybody else was doing, the escrow agent said, you know, we get all this money and it never makes any interest. I wish somebody would do something about creating an account so we could put it in there. And lo and behold, we have exactly what she was asking for. So the point was that the money's not gaining interest in doing anything now. So this is a real opportunity to earn interest and create a fund and supplement what you're doing. Would that not be correct, Mr. Refine?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, in the week run another program that it's the acronym is called LRF, which I think, if I remember, stands for Low Income Rental Assistance. It was a law that was passed probably in the mid to early 90s that directed people who were property managers to put deposits that take deposits either first or last month rents and cleaning deposits that they were to be put into income-bearing accounts, and the spin-off of that, those interests were put into this account that would be used to help supplement or subsidize people of low interest for getting them assistance in maybe if they were going to be evicted, if they didn't have enough rent, if they were having anomalies in their life, not that they were out of a job and they weren't going to have a job, but if for some reason the breadwinner was maybe had an accident that was going to be out of commission for 30 days and they weren't going to be able to have their rent money available, this was a source that we ran within our agency to help that family get that bridge so they would be able to stay in place, because obviously keeping families in place is a lot more desirable than moving them in and out. Then the law changed. There was a change from being a requirement to more of a if you want to. And interestingly enough, in the last 4 years since the law has changed, there are property management companies that still use this program and that still feed money, even though they're not required to, because I think a lot of them, as Senator Walker has mentioned, that people say, you know, here's a resource that is collected. Why not try to figure out something else to do with it? And so we have a lot of people who still participate in that, even though the law doesn't require them to participate anymore.
Very good. Questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
We have Gary Conklin, Janet Bird, and Michael Anderson. Basically, sign up as neutral. I don't know where Mr. Conklin is. He didn't sign up. Be neutral or for?
I didn't.
I've signed up, but I don't know what your position is.
It's a surprise.
Okay.
I'll go first, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Gary Conklin, here today representing Oregon Home, which is a public and private consortium formed to implement consensus recommendations of metropolitan leaders in Portland on market-oriented strategies to address the growing problem of affordable housing. We applaud the Oregon Realtors for acknowledging the issue of affordable housing as reflected by this bill, but just wanted to take a moment today to ask the committee to reflect on the exact proportion of the problem, which is considerably larger than what this bill addresses. Just a tidbit of history. Last session, legislation was introduced that would have proposed a narrow exemption from the state's existing preemption on new local real estate transfer fees. The exemption was sought for a regional housing trust. It would have been established by the affirmative action of a majority of cities and counties in the Portland metropolitan region. The measure would have permitted a real estate transfer fee to be imposed regionally, and it was estimated at a fee of 0.75%, and it would have generated $50 million annually for market-oriented incentives for affordable housing. Many people felt that amount would just begin to address the problems in the region. And I think it's important for you to kind of recognize, whether or not you agree or disagree with the real estate transfer fee, the size of the problem that we have, which is getting larger each year. In addition, the problem is much more complex than just dealing with first-time home buyers. The Oregon Home proposal did, in fact, have provisions that related to first-time home buyer mortgage assistance, and we agree with that. But it also addressed issues relating to affordability for renters, especially senior citizens and disabled persons, people at lower incomes where housing is not easily built and many existing programs don't adequately encourage it to be built. There's no easy way to ensure affordable housing, but there are some principles that we would encourage you to reflect on and embrace as you consider this and other legislation. First, our goal should be to encourage and empower complete communities where people can afford to work and live, and where people are able to retire close to their families and friends. A survey last year of metropolitan mayors indicated complete communities are a widely shared aspiration between communities as widely divergent as Troutdale and Lake Oswego. Where possible, we should move forward with consensus. Affordable housing, like job centers, are not evenly distributed in regions or individual cities, so a range of options and incentives are required to ensure that added housing stock gets built where it is most needed. Incentives are needed to help communities provide a range of affordable housing, including well-designed rental units. And the problem won't solve itself. Any serious solution will include a serious funding source. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I see the testimony is basically going to be the same. I would appreciate if you wouldn't read from it, just speak to the part. Summarizes.
I'll try to be brief.
I think we've got the message that this isn't the answer to the whole problem. It's very complex and we need more funds. This might be a start, but that's kind of it.
Okay.
Could I ask Mr. Conkling a question before we move on? I have to go to an appointment. Mr. Conkling, you're a lawyer, right?
No, I'm not.
You're not? I thought you were. Well, I elevated you to a status you didn't have, but I'll just tell you that lawyers, for their client trust accounts, they can't keep the interest on that money either. And all that money goes to help low-income people get access lawyers and lawyer fees. So I just think this is a neat way to do the same thing, only for affordable housing. And I agree with the chair. This might not get at the big picture that you want to get at, but it's a small chip, and it's a pretty big small chip.
If I may, Mr. Chair, and Senator Walker, I don't disagree with that a bit, and I think that's a very fair characterization and why we're not here to oppose this bill. But we are here because we don't have a hearing on a real estate transfer fee in this building. There won't be one this session. The funding source that we've recommended and has been the consensus of a group of leaders in the metropolitan area is sitting in a committee where it won't be heard. So you'll pardon us for taking the occasion of another bill to talk about.
Well, that's good. Well, let's let these folks have
their time. Senator Nelson, members of the committee, my name is Janet Bird, and I'm here today representing the Neighborhood Partnership Fund. And you have my written testimony as well as on the back some facts about housing need in Oregon. And in the interest of brevity, I won't repeat too much. I would just say that I think the housing crisis in Oregon is a structural crisis and created in some part by influx of new affluent workers in the high-tech industry, retirees from higher-priced housing markets, and of city workers into rural areas close to urban centers. And what this has created for our communities is high home sales prices and skyrocketing rents across the state. This leaves long-time residents, the elderly, the disabled, people making minimum wage with nowhere to go. The solution that we're proposing, the real estate transfer fee, is proven to work. And one example is Florida, the state of Florida. 12 years ago, housing advocates in Florida joined with the Florida Real Estate Association and the Florida Home Builders Association to create the Florida Housing Coalition. That coalition exists to this day, generating millions of dollars every year for, they divide it on a percentage basis between a state housing trust fund that funds projects statewide and locally developed projects. Their trust fund stands now at about $165 million, and that's in addition to the annually generated revenues. So we know this is a proven solution. And as Mr. Conkling said, it's something that we would appreciate being able to talk more about and move forward on. So thank you very much.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Michael Anderson, and I work for the Community Development Network We are an organization, our members are community development organization, developers of affordable housing in Multnomah County. I will not continue to repeat some of the earlier points my colleagues have made, but just jump straight to the real estate transfer fee as a real solution for our housing crisis. I think that the $300,000 to $500,000 that could be produced by this bill is excellent. I think the fact that a transfer fee annually could produce just in the metro area an estimates of upwards of $20 million is much more excellent and something that we need to strive for. Perhaps more importantly, though, than just this as a tool to meet our affordable housing crisis, the wonderful thing about developing housing is it creates jobs and economic opportunity. Since 1990, Oregon Community Development has produced over 7,500 units, which has produced 5,500 jobs in construction, finance, professional services, and the sales of goods and products. These jobs have generated $200 million in local wages. For every dollar the state of Oregon invests in affordable housing, we leverage $4.33 in federal and private sector money. Certainly, in these extremely tight times, we cannot fail to take advantage of this opportunity, and the real estate transfer fee is the type of thing that could generate a large amount of money right away into a tool that could create jobs for Oregon. We need this for affordable housing. We need this for Oregon's economy. I hope that we can get heard. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. What do you think about going in and harvesting some of our own forests in Oregon rather than going to Canada?
Well, I consider myself a housing expert, and I don't necessarily have the expertise to go across into that.
I mean, it seems to me they might be related. Questions?
Well, basically a comment. I'm sure the proponents feel like, you know, the old adage, you don't know, good deed goes unpunished. people talk about the issue, and I do appreciate all the comments of the panelists here. I think this is a critical issue in the state, affordable housing, and the only thing I would comment on is I'm regardless of how one might view about different ways to obtain success in this arena, I'm disappointed that, you know, you weren't able to get a hearing on this important issue over in the House, and would only say to you, as my own feeling is one thing I've been very, very pleased about in the Senate, is that regardless of how we might view an issue, we're not afraid at all to talk about any issue that's important to the state. So I'm saddened that this issue hasn't been aired adequately with the different bills that you have brought forth there. But at the same standpoint, as you have also acknowledged, appreciate the Oregon Association of Realtors, you know, doing this part. And if that adds a greater voice to this whole issue that we can expand upon, so be it. But I do appreciate the fact that we can air those things over in this chamber. Thank you.
I guess my other comment is I think you ought to be taking a position on whether or not we should be harvesting some of our trees. We've got 25,000 Oregonians guardians that are not employed in the last 10 years. I mean, it's all connected. It's all related somewhere or another. So, I mean, you just can't put your issue out there by itself. It's, everything is, and that's jobs. What do you think?
Well, it's all land use.
We could go on for this one. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Stuart, it's Branham. Stuart?
Yeah.
Welcome, sir.
Chairman Nelson, members of the committee, my name is Stuart Branham, and I'm a volunteer commissioner with the Oregon Disability Commission, and I'm here also to talk about housing and the need for transfer fee in the state of Oregon. As you can see, I'm disabled, and I could be easily one of those customers for housing that would be assisted by a transfer fee. I served two terms in the as a city councilor for the city of Corvallis, Oregon, and so I know what programs. What it means to have programs to help the populace of that community. We have a number of housing programs, and we have reached out to a number of different people in need of housing in Corvallis. So the Oregon Disability Commission believes that the real estate transfer fee could be a tool that would help people in need in the city, in the state of Oregon, and I would urge you to talk to your colleagues about permitting us to present a bill, and open a bill that would permit each of us to discuss the real estate transfer fee and to vote on it and to bring it to the people, the needy people in the state of Oregon. Thank you very much, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you for coming up and testifying.
Thank you.
Second time you've been before our committee, correct?
I'm sure.
Appreciate that very much.
Thank you.
Very good. Okay, we have no further folks signed up to testify on House Bill 2639, so we'll close the public hearing, open the board session on 2639.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2639 to the floor with the DPAS recommendation.
Senator Metzger has moved House Bill 2639 as amended to the floor with the DPAS recommendation. Discussions? Objections? So ordered. And Senator Walker has made a guess. Do you want to fight with her?
I won't fight with her at all. Whatever you want to do, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
There you go. Senator Barlow.
Senator Walker's actually moved a request. I like the chair.
Now the truth is out.
She's very passionate about this one. So, okay, we'll open up a public hearing on 2230, House Bill 2230. Mr. Dodson.
House Bill 2230, A and Gross, allows Public Utility Commission to assume primary responsibility for resolving consumer complaints relating to unauthorized changes in telecommunication carriers in violation of federal laws. Specifies that PUC may not impose more stringent rules or penalties for slamming than what is allowed at the federal level. Prohibits the PUC from adopting rules related to radio common carriers. There is a subsequent referral of Ways and Means. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and there are -5 amendments.
Very good. Senator Byer.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Senators, for the record, I'm Lee Byer, Commissioner at the Oregon Public Utility Commission. We bring you today this House bill, which is a consumer protection bill for telephone services. It specifically deals with the problems of unauthorized changes in long-distance carriers. And it's better known as slamming in the industry. Essentially, what we're asking is that you allow Oregon to join 36 other states in opting into a program of consumer protection offered through the Federal Communications Commission. It's fairly restricted in that way. Essentially, what we want to do is help people who've had their phones slammed get it corrected. It's that simple, Mr. Chair. It does not apply to wireless. That was a concern that was raised in the House. We took that out. It's fairly narrow. It conforms to just to the federal standards that have been set out. That was a concern in the House. And it puts the primary responsibility with the PUC. I believe that you'll hear an amendment from the Department of Justice. We made a slight little error, I think, when we had it there, but I'll let them explain that in terms of we took away some of their existing authority by accident. So I'll let them address that. I don't believe there's any opposition to the bill, although one can be surprised in this process. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Cheryl, Paul Romaine, and Jim Long.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini, Oregon Department of Justice, Assistant Attorney General with the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section. There are -1 amendments to this bill, and I'm sorry. I just have a copy of the LC. There are -A5s. My mistake. And this is what happened in the House side. And why these amendments are necessary. It was the consensus of all of the interest groups that looked at this 2230, the House bill, that it not change or affect at all the Attorney General's existing authority under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act to pursue companies who engage in a pattern or practice of slamming. What 2230 does is it offers an individual, an informal dispute resolution method to address a single slam. Because of how the Unlawful Trade Practices Act itself is drafted, We realized a little bit too late after the bill got out of the House that 2230 as drafted would deprive the Department of Justice of the jurisdiction it now has. And this is why. The Unlawful Trade Practices Act, it applies to transactions involving real estate, goods, or services. There's a definition for that phrase in the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and that's at ORS 646-605, subsection 7. In the definition of real estate, goods, or services, that primarily means those that are for personal use, or if they are solicited by telephone solicitation for any use. The Act goes on to define telephone solicitation as a solicitation that is made by a person for the purpose of trying to get them to buy goods or services. Then there are exemptions. Telephone solicitation carves out a number of industries, and among them, it carves out persons or affiliates of a person whose business is regulated by the Public Utilities Commission. The reason that hasn't been a problem heretofore is because until House Bill 2230, the Public Utilities Commission did not have jurisdiction over long-distance companies. House Bill 2230 would give them that jurisdiction. By giving them that jurisdiction, it would also deprive us of jurisdiction that we now have under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. What the Dash 5 amendments do is they basically say that nothing in House Bill 2230 would affect the ability of the Attorney General or any other person to seek remedies under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, that's 646-605 to 646-652, to the extent that it involves an unauthorized change in telecommunication carriers that would constitute an unlawful practice under the Act. So it basically puts us where we thought we were when we left the House, but for the vagary of the definition in the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. It's a very long explanation.
Thank you.
And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Mr. Roman, you can stay there if you like. I guess we have some questions there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romain. I'm a much older version of Cheryl. I once was in her position as head of then the Consumer Protection Division at the Department of Justice, administering the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. I'm here representing MCI Telecommunications, which is now called MCI Telecommunications once again, fortunately. I have a problem with the amendments. We support the bill as it came out of the House. I have a problem with the amendments, and let me explain why. I have a general policy one and a practical one. And again, we haven't had a lot of time to look at these amendments. I would request that you would not do anything today on this bill and give us a chance to think some stuff through, because actually Cheryl came up with a fairly interesting idea out in the hall that I want to pursue, and that involves having her jurisdiction in a separate bill. There is a reason why you exempt regulated entities from the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. It's because you don't want to have two hammers, basically. The state right now has, you can regulate something and control it that way. Give consumer protection through regulation. Or you can set up some kind of way for the private industry or the Attorney General or the District Attorney to go after them, which you do through the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. The Unlawful Trade Practices Act, with the telephone solicitations, basically says currently, look, if you're currently regulated by the PUC, which would be your local exchange carriers, that they're not subject to the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. If you're regulated by the PUC for telephone solicitation purpose, you're not subject to it. Now you're bringing, we're going to be regulated by the PUC, rightly so, because that's where everybody calls when they have a complaint about what we, you know, if we do slam or somebody does slam in our name or somebody else slams out there. And yet with long distance, you're saying, well, you know, gosh, we really we're going to stick you with PUC regulation, but just for you, we're going to make sure the AG and the private attorneys and the district attorney can also still go after you. Our problem isn't necessarily with sort of the broad coverage. When this was explained in the House, really where Cheryl explained it in the House, which I thought was very good, and she again explained it here, the AG tends to go after these sort of large things when you see a pattern of abuse. But the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, as applied to me as an attorney, for example, I can take an individual slamming complaint if it's subject to unlawful trade practices jurisdiction and go after them if we're still subject to it. So not only would you have the PUC regulating, but you'd have individual attorneys out there still being able to file lawsuits and get minimum damages plus attorney fees plus everything else. So what we'd like a little time to do is to look at this and figure out just where we want to go with the Department of Justice on this thing. Cheryl had suggested a separate bill basically affirming, in effect, broad jurisdiction for the Department of Justice to go after the, you know, when there's sort of a pattern of abuse kind of situation out there, and then leaving these individual complaints to the PUC, which this bill does very nicely. And we would like to pursue that. But I need a little more time to think it through. My thoughts have changed a lot in the last hour. Actually, the more I think about it, the more I actually go against these amendments. But I can go back. Anyway, I would like just a little more time to think it through.
Were you a former member of the legislature?
I was never a member of the legislature. I was accused once of being a member of the legislature by a weekly newspaper in Portland, and I've never lived that down.
Cheryl, do you want to respond to what the ball is doing?
If I may, Mr. Chair, a couple of things. As far as the private cause of action in a business being subject to sort of a double slam itself for having slammed a consumer, I would say this. It wouldn't be the Attorney General's office that would be taking a case if it was just one consumer, because we're prohibited by law from doing that. An individual consumer who, having availed him or herself of the PUC's informal practice, I think would have a very difficult time filing a lawsuit under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, because at that point, to get in the door under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, a person has to show that they've suffered some ascertainable loss. If they have been made whole by the PUC's practice, I think it would be very difficult to bring a private action on top of that, because there would be no loss at that point. So that would just be a consideration. Having said that, the bill that Mr. Romaine is alluding to, the alternative bill, is the Department of Justice's bill, Senate Bill 120. What that does is that it sets up a whole separate statute for the Department of Justice to go after slamming complaints. It sets up a disclosure requirement for the company, and then instead of being tied to the Unlawful Trade Practices Act for remedies, it lists a tiered penalty provision that puts people on notice very clearly about what sort of penalties they may be in for if they engage in a pattern, and it's, you know, 1 to 10, 10 to 15, over 20. So that was our bill. We'd be delighted if the committee would entertain that in lieu of these amendments. But one way or the other, it's important for the Department of Justice to retain some jurisdiction over companies, because if 2230 passes with no amendment and no Senate Bill 120, what that means is that there will be no agency in Oregon that will be able to levy a civil penalty or bring a lawsuit to stop a company that engages in an unlawful pattern of practice. Individuals would be able to get their own cases heard, but no one is going to be able to address slamming the way that, frankly, the Department of Justice has been since 1995, and we think that there is certainly a continued need for that.
Could I ask the witness a question? Okay. Mr. Chair, I would like to know, actually, because I'm a bit confused on this, under current currently, does the Department of Justice have the legal authority to go after telephone solicitations, violations by regulated local exchange carriers? For example, a Quest, a Verizon. Not that, that any of them would ever engage in such a practice. However, do they have the current authority to do so, or are they exempt under that specific exemption for folks regulated by the PUC? That's what I'm more curious about.
We'll have to ask that.
We have gone after telecommunications carriers, Mr. Chair, for long-distance slamming.
Sort of. Thank you.
Okay,
we can. We'll meet in the hall.
Okay, well, we can get the PUC commissioner up here also. Would you like to come up, Lee, and answer that question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a little bit of deja vu. We went through this on the other side and got to an agreement on it. The original amendment to our bill, and when we started on the House side, had a provision that the PUC's activities would be the exclusive remedy, which I will tell you most of the telcos were opposed to also. There is a reason to have both the Department of Justice and the Public Utility Commission involved in this, and it's a different way of doing it. The Utility Commission now does not have the authority to go in and work on behalf of the customer. But most of the customers who are slammed, who want something done about it, they want something done right away, they call us. Under the current system, when they call us, we say, we're sorry, we don't have authority to do that, but you can call the FCC and give them the number, or you can call the Department of Justice. If they call the FCC, which, by the way, only has about 20 people nationally who deal with all of the telephone problems, they look up on their computer and say, well, in Oregon, you should call the PUC. Which, of course, they say, we just came from there, and they sent us you, and they have no ability to effectively help them out. The Department of Justice can, but under state laws, I understand it, and correct me if I say this wrong, the Department of Justice cannot take action on the part of an individual Oregonian. Their authority is limited to taking actions against companies that commit violations of the Unfair Trade Practices Act. When they do that, the remedies that they get come to the general fund. They do not correct individual circumstances. I think that's an important service, and there are a number of cases, I'm not going to bring them up, there are a few that have come up in both our individual consumer complaint section and in the Attorney General's report that was just issued about a month ago now. The top number one violation was telecommunications. That's what Oregonians are concerned about. It's a byproduct of opening the competitive marketplace. People don't like what happens to them. People are in business to try and make money. There is nothing in this bill that causes any company that's complying with the law any problem at all. None at all. If they're complying with the law, everything is fine. We'll never get a call. It's only when somebody chooses to try to steal from one of the customers that we're going to get a call. Under this bill, what the PUC will do is we will try to informally work with the customer and the company to correct their obvious oversight. And we are usually successful with that kind of things and other things. If we're not successful, and if we have a company that continues repeatedly a number of times to create a pattern of abuse, then the Department of Justice will get involved. I don't think you want to take away their authority to do that. We discussed that, as I said, in the House committee, having looked at an exclusive remedy, chose not to do that. That's the bill you have in front of you. It's a bill that was well debated in the House, and one that the House, at least, and I believe it passed unanimously, supported. Okay. I think it's a good bill. I think the amendment is reasonable. It corrects an oversight.
Thank you. We can continue this discussion. I would like to give you an opportunity to discuss this with this amendment. So.
Thank you.
So, Jim Long is the last one.
Thank you very much.
Jim, what I intend to do is I don't intend to move the bill today. We'll let you guys kind of work out some of these amendments, that sort of thing. But Jim's out here and wants to testify. Please step up. Jim Long, I don't see him. Okay, so we'll close the public hearing on 2230. We'll not go into work session. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2564. You guys going to cause us a lot of problems on this one, are you?
No, sir. We're going to make Oregon a better place to live.
Yeah, that's
what I'm thinking.
Okay. Mr. Dodson, what's this one do?
House Bill 2564A in gross requires the Department of Consumer Business Services to establish a licensing system that allows contractors with two or more licenses, certificates, or other authorizations by the Electrical and Elevator Board, Board of Boiler Rules, or State Plumbing Board to have a combination of licenses, certificates, or other authorizations issued or renewed simultaneously. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no amendments.
You guys had a work session on this, and we're pretty much in agreement. Keep her pretty brief here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Murray. I'm with the United Association of Plumbers and Steamfitters. If you are a licensed contractor in the state of Oregon, for example, I'll use a plumbing contractor, you must be licensed by the Building Codes Division as a plumbing contractor. If, perchance, your scope of work also gets involved, for example, electrical, you also must be licensed in the state of Oregon as an electrical contractor. And if you're a pressure vessel contractor and so forth and so on, many times these license periods overlap. Some might be for a period of a year and some for a period of 2 years, some period of 3 years, so forth and so on. What this bill does, it allows the contractor to write one check to Building Codes Division to pay for whatever number of licenses they choose to have. It doesn't change the requirements for a license. It doesn't change the fees that they'll pay for a license. But one of the concerns that the contractors have, believe it or not, is they're just going to miss that billing statement because they never quite know which one's coming and with all the paperwork they have and so forth and so on. And it just allows them the opportunity to write one check to the state.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, Burton Weist, on behalf of the Plumbing, Heating, Cooling Contractors and the Air Conditioning Contractors of America, we co-sponsored the bill along with 290. And Ron said it very well. This is just a paperwork simplification bill that's going to help our contractors. And we did do some amendments on the House side that resolved some technical issues with the Building Code Division. But as far as I know, there's no issues, no problems, and the bill is good to go as written.
Any questions?
I like good government streamlining.
Very good. Okay, I don't have any further people sign up to testify, so we will close the public hearing and open up a work session on House Bill 2564. There's no amendments, are there?
No.
So the chair would move House Bill 2564 to floor with a due pass recommendation. Comments? Objections? So ordered. And
you
want to carry that? Roger, okay. The DAS-3 amendments are ready on Senate Bill 103. Open up, reopen up the, we had a work session on that, is that correct?
Correct.
Everybody got those 103s and had a chance to look at them? Mr. Fuller, do you want to discuss those?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you, Darrell Fuller, for the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. The DAS-3 amendments before you are an agreement between the New and Used Car Dealers Association and the Attorney General's Office. When we sell a car to a consumer, generally on a weekend or in the evening, and the financing has not been approved, but we have the credit rating scores and all the information we need, we'll send them out in the car contingent on approval of financing. And in very rare cases, less than 1%, the financing doesn't come back approved immediately. In some cases, the applicant has misstated some of their work history, or they can't verify income, or there's some problems that we need to get a hold of the customer, get some more information. The Attorney General's Office introduced the bill the way the bill was originally introduced. If we couldn't get the financing approved within, like the original bill said, 15 days or 14 days, then the deal was automatically void, and we'd have to bring the customer back in and re-sign the contract. And we had some concerns about notifying the customer that we couldn't get the contract purchased, asking them to bring the car back. And in the meantime, the contract would be approved, but we wouldn't be able to do the deal because we'd have to rescind it even though it had been approved. The concern the Attorney General office had is when we send a vehicle out contingent on approval, if we can't get them bought by a financial institution and they have to bring the vehicle back, We have to return the trade-in to them and any down payments, but we get to charge them a mileage fee while they had our car. And the Attorney General's office was worried that a car dealer could string along a consumer long enough that it would be so expensive to return the car based on the mileage fee that they're better off by the consumer would be better off purchasing the car at a higher interest rate, and that would put the dealer in an advantageous position to get the consumer to buy the car at a higher interest rate because they couldn't afford to bring it back based on the mileage charge. So the compromise that we've come up with that are incorporated in the Dash 3 amendments are that the dealer has 20 days to get the deal bought, and if they can't get it bought in 20 days, that they can no longer charge mileage to the customer if the customer has to come back prior to that 20 days. So in other words, beyond 20 days, there's no longer an incentive for the dealer to keep stringing the customer out because the dealer's not going to get any mileage after that. So it encourages the dealer to make sure the financing gets done within the 20 days. It's also an incentive to the dealer to get it done within 20 days because if we don't secure perfect our security interest within 20 days, we lose our rights under in bankruptcy law. So this is a bill that will take care, we believe, of the Attorney General's problems, but still allow the dealer to work beyond the original 14 days to get a deal purchased if that's necessary. I'd be glad to answer any questions you have.
Any questions about the DAS needs? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just glancing through, obviously, the first time, but in the DAS 3s, and I don't know if Mr. Fuller or Mr. Dawson can answer the question or if anybody can, you're mending on Section 2, ORS 646-608, and I'm looking for the amendment. I can't find one in that section.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Senator Beyer.
The
amendment is in the back of the bill. And
page.
What it does is it changes the subsection.
Page 5, line 11, Senator Beyer.
That the unlawful trade practice exactly for
there it is.
It takes a little effort to find some of them.
Okay.
Is that good enough?
That's right. Fine.
Okay, so we're in work session. Chair would move the one of the Dash 3 amendments. Senate Bill 103. Questions, discussions, objections? So ordered. The chair would move Senate Bill 103 to forward the due pass recommendation as amended. Discussion. Objections? So ordered.
I'll carry that.
Okay, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just for Senator Metzger's information, I believe the amendment to the Section 3 of the amendments is also the same thing. It's in the very back page, changing the letter number 5, number 4 again. Pretty technical stuff.
Yeah. Okay, open up public hearing on 2623 as amended.
Also, 2623. A, reduces the amount of deposits required permitted from $100 million to $50 million under the insurance code for Class 1 rated corporations. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller here today on behalf of Liberty Northwest Companies. The bill before you came out of the House with a unanimous support. I will say that the summary in the bill is a little misleading. It says it modifies the amount of the deposit required or permitted under an insurance code. It doesn't modify the amount of the deposit that is required, for instance, in workers' compensation. The deposits that you have on hand are there to pay the claims. Currently, Liberty Northwest has about $260 million of deposits. ORS 731-640 lists what those deposit requirements must be. For instance, cash, municipal bonds, certificates of deposit, surety. You get down to lines 15 through 17 of the bill, deal with the corporate bonds and investment in corporate securities. And these securities must be rated as NAIC, which is the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, as Class 1. The current requirement now is anything above $100 million. So, for instance, in Liberty's case, $260 million, anything above that amount could then be invested in those kinds of securities. and they must be rated Class 1. We have worked with the insurance division, Russell Latham actually is here from the insurance division who we worked with, and actually lowered that amount to $50 million. Anything above that could be invested in security corporate bonds, because many of some of those bonds are better than municipal. The change allows this increased flexibility in the investment portfolio, and that's the idea of an investment portfolio, is to get the best out of the money that you have, and it has no significant impact of the quality or the liquidity of the eligible deposits. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have no amendments. We did amend it on the House side, though, to allow the insurance division to adopt rules to require periodic review of these obligations so they can make sure that they stay Class 1 rated by NAIC, and they are, again, these financial transactions are regulated by the insurance commission. They're okay with the bill, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer. And the letter that you have is from Jim McKittrick, our chief financial officer of the company.
Questions? Well, you're the only person that's specified.
And Mr. Chair, because Liberty is the only company that this applies to, SAFE, as you know, is not regulated by the insurance division of their investments, and we're the only company that has above this required amount, so that's why.
You have deposit requirements of $260 million.
Well, that's our current deposit. This only changes how we can invest the money above, if we want to invest in corporate, above that $50 million mark. You can make those choices in your portfolio.
Thank you, sir. Close public hearing on House Bill 2623. Open up a work session on House Bill 2623. And Chair would move House Bill 2623 as well as due pass recommendation. Questions? Objections? So ordered. I guess I can play that one. And I think the only item we have is an informational hearing on Senate Bill 477. And Ted Hughes was here a moment ago. Anybody in the room testifying on 477 or giving information? I think he has a couple folks coming in from out of town, so we'll sit in recess for a few minutes here. And see if we can't find him. They were flying in, and I think they were for a deadline. 477. See you. We'll open up as a subcommittee on Senate Bill 477 informational hearing purposes.
Want me to go hurry him up?
Yeah, well, just go ahead, sit down, and talk to us a little bit.
Sure.
You get this other fellow come in and introduce yourself, David.
Well, I'm David Lloyd, and I'm Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Paint and Coatings Association. Our only offices are in Washington, D.C. We do have, as Ted Hughes may have told you, a sort of a chapter in the Pacific Northwest made up of the companies that manufacture paints and coatings, their raw materials suppliers, and we've set up a bi-state paint council, Pacific Northwest Paint Council. The reason being is that most of the companies involved have operations in both states. So for purposes of economy and commonality of interests, we've had this thing now for, I guess, about 10 years or so. And the the primary focus generally is health, safety, and environmental issues that would affect the paint industry. It is a subcategory, I guess, of the chemical industry. And so we have some of the, in a very limited way, some of the issues.
Can you give a brief biography of your guest that's coming in?
Don Gifford is currently a professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, having served as dean of the Maryland University School of Law for a period of about 7 years or so, and I believe also the dean at the West Virginia University School of Law as well. He also, and it's the reason why I got to know him, served as chairman of the Maryland Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention Study Commission back in 1992. And he had a commission, I'm not sure the exact number of people, but he had virtually every single interest group that would be interested in the issue. Paint company, landlords, insurance, activists, you name it, they were all involved in this commission. And over a period of about, I guess maybe less than a year, they crafted a report which became the basis for legislation which was enacted in 1994, which is the basis for Senate Bill 477. And essentially, and I'll let him go into more of the details, but the report felt that there needed to be a new focus on going after those properties which, for one reason or another, have been allowed to fall into disrepair. Dean Gifford?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, if you give me just a second, I might be better if I have my notes in front of me. It's been a long trip, but it's a real privilege to be with you, and I want to thank you for taking the time this afternoon to tackle this difficult bill. Let me give you, if I may, some handouts. Thank you very much. As Mr. Lloyd has probably told you, I'm a professor of law at the University of Maryland and the former chair of the Maryland Lead Paint Poisoning Commission that drafted between 1992 and 1994 the Maryland Lead Paint Poisoning Prevention Statute. My appearance today is sponsored by the National Paint and Coatings Associations. I'm sure it's somewhat tempting here in Oregon, a state in which I once lived in for several months, to think of childhood lead poisoning as a problem that is largely exists in gritty industrial cities such as Baltimore or St. Louis. And yet the data tell a different story. One in five Oregonian children tested in the mid-1990s had elevated blood levels. Childhood lead poisoning arises almost entirely from older, deteriorated paint in homes. And the data from the 1990 census shows that in many of the counties in the state, including Multnomah County and several of the other most populous counties, that more than a third of all housing predates 1950 and therefore is among the housing that poses the highest risk. There are lead poisoned children in every county in this state, among every race, and at every socioeconomic level. But I suspect that your initial instincts are correct. It is older, deteriorated, poorly maintained housing that is the chief source of childhood lead poisoning. One study in the state of Rhode Island, a state in which we've been successful in the last several years in enacting very progressive and very effective legislation, found that less than 2% of all landlords were responsible for more than 50% of the cases of childhood lead poisoning. What happens with childhood lead poisoning? Well, to put it in its bluntest terms, we're talking about children losing 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 IQ points directly as a result of lead poisoning. We're talking about children who have an increased propensity for behavioral disorders. We're talking about children who have additional risk to their cardiovascular systems, their digestive systems, and even stunted growth. We're talking about state expenditures resulting from childhood lead poisoning of more special education teachers, more probation officers and prison officials. And therefore, I submit to you today that the expensive thing to do is to do nothing about this problem. Now, Senate Bill 447 is modeled after the best provisions of our statute in Maryland, as well as provisions in several other states, including Massachusetts, Wisconsin, and Rhode Island. National Centers for the National Center for Lead Safe Housing has shown that some relatively inexpensive repairs to older housing can almost entirely eliminate childhood lead poisoning. And today we have the results to prove it. 7 years after the enactment of the Maryland legislation, we've had a 84% decrease in childhood lead poisoning. Now, the Maryland design in the bill before you is not a simple design. This is something that resulted, quite frankly, from taking landlords and advocates for lead-poisoned children, Department of Health people, people from the paint industry, and others, and essentially what we did is we locked them in rooms on Thursday afternoons during the course of an entire summer, starting at 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and when we got down to the final sessions, we sometimes went until 1 o'clock in the morning. And my guess is that if you were to do exactly the same thing with the affected parties here in the state of Oregon, that you would end up with a result that would look very, very much like Senate Bill 447. But in the meantime, hundreds or thousands of additional children would be poisoned. This bill does three things to substantially eliminate childhood lead poisoning. First of all, it eliminates lead hazards in housing, and we'll talk about that issue in just a moment. Second, it provides for education for parents, for child care workers, for landlords, for real estate agents, as well as for medical personnel. And third, it provides for screening of children so that we can detect the problem before it becomes too serious and does too much permanent damage. The key, though, is the requirement in this legislation that pre-1978 housing be required by statute to be lead safe. That's a requirement that does not exist under current Oregon law. Largely, what we're talking about here are some fairly simple treatments to friction surfaces, to windows, to doors. It is those friction surfaces that produce lead dust. And typically what happens is the child, 1 or 2 years of age, crawling around on their hands and knees, picks up dust on their fingertips, the fingertips goes into their mouth, and soon we have that child who has lost the 15 or 20 IQ points and is a behavioral problem. We would require people who provide food products, people who provide beverages to adults, not to contaminate their products with toxic substances. And yet, landlords today are in effect exposing our most vulnerable populations to exactly those kind of things. So we're going to require landlords to clean up the premises. What are we giving landlords in exchange? Well, the bill calls for tax credits. It calls for a revolving loan fund to be funded by the sale of bonds. And it calls for liability protection. At the current time, landlords throughout the country are being sued in a small number of cases and are being held liable for as much as $1 million or more per suit. Most of that money is going for pain and suffering damages. Most of that money is going for lawyers' fees. And so what we end up with is there isn't a lot of money that's going to help the children, and it's only the one children out of 1,000 that is being helped by the legal system. What we're saying is that if a landlord complies with these standards, they have immunity from liability, except that they have to pay the actual medical and rehabilitation expenses. But I'll tell you that, quite frankly, that's not going to happen very often. Because if a landlord complies with these simple, inexpensive standards, there will be very few lead-poisoned children. Under existing law, the landlord has no guarantees. Even the responsible landlord who does everything that we would possibly want him or her to do could still end up on the losing side of a $1 million lawsuit because the child is poisoned at grandma's house or at the daycare center or at a neighbor's house. Conversely, on the other side of the equation, what we're saying to the landlord is if you do not comply with these standards, then that the lead-poisoned child and the attorneys have a presumption of liability working in their favor. And finally, what we found in the state of Rhode Island and elsewhere is that if a landlord complies with this standard, that insurance companies are willing to offer insurance coverage at a reasonable cost. When we did it in Maryland, it turned out to be between $19 and $38 a unit to protect the landlord from any probability or any possibility of the million-dollar judgment. So we think that the proposal that you have before you is a balanced one. On one hand, it saves children. But on the other hand, it gives the landlords the incentives, both criminal incentives. There's a provision calling for a $5,000 fine for landlords that don't comply, but also all of these incentives that will help them meet their demands under this new law. And I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have about Senate Bill 447.
There's been a fair amount of skepticism about this proposal. I mean, you're explaining some of the reasons why you're trying to find a balance between all the parties. I guess when people talk about lead safe or lead free, you think about asbestos and all the huge problems that causes. Is there any comparison similarities between the asbestos situation and this situation?
Well, there are, of course, some similarities in that both of them are toxic substances and both of them produce health effects. I'm not sure. It would be helpful to me, or it may be helpful to you, the skepticism is coming from whom and what's the nature of the skepticism?
Basically, landlords, insurance folks, right. Property owners. Just like we're thinking about the cost here, I guess. It's going to be prohibitive for us.
Well, I think that I'll have to say to you that at the beginning of this proposal in Maryland, those same groups were extraordinarily skeptical and hostile. As we progressed through the process, a majority of the landlords on the commission that I chaired endorsed a roughly comparable piece of legislation, and that talking to the one representative of the landlord who remained a negative vote six or 7 years later, I ran into him and asked him how things were going, and he said that it was all working quite well and it hadn't proved to be a terrible problem, and that there was none of the abandonment of housing that had, the parade of horribles that had been advertised back in 1994. So I think it's worked quite well.
So you indicated that you're going to eliminate lead, but then another thing you say, make it lead safe. And it seems to me that is elimination, or are you painting over it or covering it up or something like that?
Well, the bill actually provides, Mr. Chairman, a series of prescribed steps as to what it takes to make premises lead safe. These are steps that were empirically tested by the National Center for Lead Safe Housing, which is a center that was founded in part by the Alliance to End Childhood Lead Poisoning. The Maryland legislation also provided the basis for what became a couple years later the HUD standards. And it is the same steps which have been endorsed by the Presidential Commission regarding eliminating childhood lead poisoning that released its report in February of the year 2000. We are not talking about getting rid of all the lead. The reason for that is quite simple. The cost of taking all lead paint out of an older unit is somewhere between $15,000 and $25,000. The cost of doing this in a well-maintained older unit most often is less than $1,200. And yet, we are able to see well over a 90% reduction in childhood lead poisoning. I cannot tell you, sir, that there will never be a case of childhood lead poisoning again if these standards are adopted. But what I am telling you is that for a tenth the cost, you're getting 99% of the benefit.
I see in your testimony today, 1 in 5 children in the site of Willamette Week. Do you know what the basis of their information was?
I do have the article with me, and I believe it was Oregon State Department of Health statistics.
Oregon Health Division, so yeah, you just said that.
This is the Oregon Health Division, that's correct.
There might be some folks that would question Willamette Week as a source.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I'm not terribly familiar with the Willamette Weekly, and if I have cited a less than perfect source, then I do apologize.
We used to have a rogue of the week. That's kind of the we're all trying to get on there.
It's a progressive newspaper.
I see.
Would you like to give us a question, sir?
No, Mr. Chair, I was just trying to help you get that foot out of your mouth.
I appreciate it.
Well, it wasn't there. I don't need it. So any questions as far as this is concerned? I mean, your address and vision, I think it's pretty, as I indicate, a lot of skepticism on this. But I want to have the opportunity for you folks to come in and make your case and talk about it. And if there's something we can do in the interim, if we can get some parties together to talk this over, to do some exploring, we'd be very happy to facilitate that. And that's what I like to see. I mean, I guess there are some issues there that we should be talking about. And there's the cost. I mean, there may be some uncertainty and unknowns here. And maybe we need.
Well, certainly, having, in a sense, lived through the experience twice, once in Maryland and once in Rhode Island when the legislation was ultimately enacted, would be delighted to help you in whatever way I can, and obviously I think you're right, and whatever you can do to help us get together with the interested parties would be, I think, greatly appreciated.
Senator, you probably got Senator Walker's interest.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, it was funny. I just got a letter today from someone from the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, and they said that 3 of the 11 bills they're tracking this session were mine, and they're opposed to them. And they felt, and one dealt with toxic mold. I think I had 2 toxic mold bills and then something else. But they suggested that maybe I should talk to their group before introducing legislation. So that would be a place for you to get started.
Okay. We will pursue that.
Okay. Well, it's just at 3 o'clock. You guys made a flying trip out here. I hope you can stick around for a day or two and enjoy the great pride and country.
Thank you.
We'll see if we can do it. Keep you entertained. How's that sound?
It sounds great. That's true.
We really do appreciate you coming out and making an excerpt. Your plane was an hour late coming in, is that what you said?
Just about, yeah. And then, well, yeah. Okay. The flight coming, we had to come out through San Francisco. And flying into and out of San Francisco Airport is, hazardous at best, I guess. And, of course, the incoming flight, the plane that was going to take us up here was, 45 minutes late. So we made up some of the time, but not.
Okay. Any further comments? Anything else you'd like to discuss?
I don't think so. I think we appreciate your interest and would like to work with the people here in this state, because we know that every state ultimately will come up with a different solution. But it is something that we would hope would be very high on your priority list.
Okay. Do you know of any lawsuits in the state of Oregon on this
I don't offhand, but I probably could check that and get some information. I'd be surprised if there haven't been some.
We'd like to maybe prevent the lawsuit, because they really don't, even the successful ones take years. And we think this is something that can be dealt with now for a relatively modest cost. If we could get there before the lawsuit, so much the better.
Okay, very good. Further questions?
Yep.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
We'll close the informational hearing on 477, and this is another business, and we're just at 3 o'clock. We will close the public hearing.
So what?